Survival Guide.
Hello.
Oh, have we started?
Yeah, I started.
Hi.
I just, you know.
I felt like you needed a countdown or something.
Oh, okay. All right.
3, 2, 1. Go.
Go, Melissa.
Hey, hello. Hey, what's up? Hey, listeners.
Oh my gosh. Yes. So here we are, podcast one. So this podcast is a true survival story podcast.
Yeah.
And our hope is that we are going to share with anyone who deigns to think they want to hear some like crazy true survival stories. Like, that's what we kind of want to deliver. So we're kind of just gonna
delve in, right?
Well, yeah, like, yeah. we're just gonna tell you a story and maybe talk about it a little. But yes, so I am Olivia and I was born and bred Wellington, New Zealand. What do? I grew up on a farm. I want to be famous. Shut up, Olivia. got big dreams for the big smoke.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've always wanted to do a podcast, and this is always a subject that has fascinated me. More so than true crime, I really like the engagement of listening to, like, crazy, awful true crime stories, but I am very squeamish and I get nightmares really easily. Like, I don't watch horror films, so yeah, like, yeah. And even just listening to a lot of true crime podcasts, of which there are numerous, I was just starting to have really bad dreams.
All right, well, no true crime for you.
Yeah, no more sugar for you before bed. Literally me. So yes, I wanted to do something that was just as engaging but maybe had a happier ending.
Yeah.
Because these people survive, whereas true crime, they do not. Quite a gruesome
name. Yeah, kind of tragic.
But tell us about you, Melissa, my good friend.
My name's Melissa. Like yourself, born and bred in Wellington. Yay, we're currently sitting in my room in my childhood. Well, it was my brother's, and then when he moved out, I was like, nope.
Yeah, you definitely
stole this one. But like, yeah, so I'm 25, living at home.
I must say as well, like, you've done a fabulous job with the setup today.
Thanks.
I'm sitting on a sheepskin chair,
yeah.
Like, rugged chair, and she's put, like, two very crystal clear glasses of water on their own, like, wooden coasters on this table.
I'm, like,
this fancy candle burning.
I'm, like, ready to nest.
And are these real flowers?
Yeah, they're dried. They're pretty.
Did you dry them yourself, or did you buy them? Well, I'm very impressed, I must say, and
thanks.
Even though you're really going down the dark route,
I still live at home. Ready to nest, cannot afford it.
It's a hard life. Plus, also, a lot of people are in the same predicament. If I could live at home, I would, but my parents live in the middle of nowhere, so
it yeah,
not the vibe, yes, but
yeah.
My goodness.
No, but it's pretty good. I've known you, Olivia, for so long.
When did you start at Chilton? At,
yes, in year 7.
Okay, so
we were like 11 or 12.
Yes.
I knew you a little bit before then.
Yes, of course. I always forget that until you bring it up.
So it's like
a long time.
I can't math.
I must say,
14?
Yeah, we've had our moments, you know, over the years.
Jesus Christ.
But Melissa, yes, an absolute character.
And yeah, all about survival stories. I think both true crime and survival stories are really interesting to talk about because I like to think about the mindsets of the people.
So true.
Whether it be the person surviving what's happening or the victim or the person who's doing a bit of murdering, you know.
Yeah, like what's happening to them in that moment. And I think as well, you yourself are quite an outdoorsy person, and while these stories won't always necessarily be about like wilderness survival stories, like, you know, there's like a very relevant interest for you there.
Yeah, like, I won't say I'm like this Adventure Jonesy sort of like very
Adventure Jones.
Like, and yes, let's go. It's somewhat at a basic level. But it's kind of crazy to think that just like humans in general can go through all of this shit.
I know. And that's why today's story is so...
I'm so excited.
It's so interesting.
You've hyped it up a little.
Yeah, I mean, it took me, like, over 6 hours of my life to write it out.
Oh, epic. Yeah,
like, literally, I spent 4 hours on this last night, and so if it sucks, I'm sorry.
I really want to start
on a high, so my story sucks. But just quickly, tell me any issues with you over the week. We want to do a little section on, like, did you survive the last week? Anything you want to share? Any tips and tricks?
I had a pretty good week. It was pretty busy. I had a bit of a rough time at the start of the week, just at work. I work at a law firm. So it's unfortunately a bit confidential, but essentially we're representing a client who's going through like a criminal prosecution at the moment. Ooh, and we're like, we're the defendant. And so I had to go through the victim impact statements because unfortunately someone died. Oh, and wow. It was heartbreaking.
Oh no.
Like I was shattered and I was just like in this really sad like mood all through the weekend because I read it on the Friday and then like
so it was just like this dark shadow
and then I had to like deal with like the legal ramifications of it on Monday like trying to delete stuff from the statement because some of it was inadmissible and but I was very like the silver lining to it was like I was just very grateful for everything that I had and all the people that I had in my life.
Okay.
Like, my mum was, like, complaining about, like, a lost AirPod, and she was just, like, devastated. And I was just like, get your priorities sorted, woman! There are people dying!
Do you know, complete footnote, but I've also lost my AirPods and I'm devastated.
Look, they're really hard.
And they're so expensive.
To, like, keep in one place.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a daily struggle.
Okay, so your, perhaps, survival tip is, like, get yourself a good support network to help you.
Find the silver linings, glass half full.
Yeah. Because you've got obviously a very loving partner who is good at talking about these things with you. So that's really cool.
Yeah.
Cool, cool, cool.
And how about you? How did you survive the week?
Oy vey. She's been a pretty interesting week for hashtag personal reasons. But I actually decided that something that I wanted to do to take my mind off things was to reach out and like do like connect a bit more with my friends that I haven't put a lot of like effort into. Mm-hmm. So on Wednesday night I went out with my flatmate. We had date night, which we haven't done in like months right. since like last year.
Yeah.
And we're in what, like almost October. So we went out on date night. And bless her soul, she paid for my dinner, and I was like, And I know that's just a little thing, but it was just that actually means a lot to me, because I always feel like I'm the person who is always going to shout someone lunch or something, but it's, like, often not reciprocated, and not that I care, but it's just, like, when somebody just does it for you, you're like, thanks.
You're like, thanks.
And then on Thursday night, my other friend, Sarah, came and picked me up from town, from the flat. Mm-hmm. We drove out to Petone, got delicious Turkish food, and then she took me back to hers, and we had a spa, and we just...
That's so lovely!
Was, like, completely dark outside. We didn't have, like, outdoor lights or anything, so we're just chilling in the spa and, just like, talking and about things. Yeah, getting deep, and it was just lovely. And then she gave me a piece of cake and drove me back into Wellington.
Oh my goodness!
And I was like, thank you so much. Like, that was just really nice. And it was only because, like, I reached out and I was like, hey, I'm having, like, a pretty tough time.
Mm.
She was just like, yep, on to it. Like, let's do this.
Oh, my goodness.
Like, thank you so much. So, really, my tip is reach out to your mates because they can surprise you.
They can pull through.
Yeah.
And it just sounds like you've, like, your friends have really taken care of like you and your like health and well-being and just being like, hey girl, like relax.
Yes. And often it's to me, just saying it out loud now, it wasn't so much the fact that we went out and I was able to like offload all of this information onto them. Like that wasn't really what stuck with me. It was more so like the little things that they did.
Yeah.
Being like, let's do date night and then paying for me and then or like picking me up and taking me out, blah, 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 and then bringing me all the way back in. It was just really nice. So, yeah, so that's my week this week.
That's lovely.
Upon that note. Y'all ready for this? Okay.
And it begins.
Okay. My story this week, Melissa, has been coined one of the greatest stories ever of disaster.
Oh, dear.
Abandonment. And survival in the mountaineering world. This is the story of the man who cut the rope. The story of Joe Simpson and Simon Yates. So, before I begin, I want to acknowledge that I did, in fact, get a lot of information for the story from this article I found on independent.co.uk. Mm-hmm. So the article is called How We Met Joe Simpson and Simon Yates, and it's an interview with Neris Lloyd Pierce. And that was in 1997. And another great source they used was from a BBC radio show in 2004, Desert Island Discs, with Sue Lawley, who actually interviews Joe about this experience. So if you want to know more, that's where I got most of my information.
Okay.
So, Melissa.
Yes.
The year is 1985, and two British climbers, Joe Simpson, who is 25, my age, and Simon Yates, who is 21, were two anarchic young men who wanted to climb the world. They set out for Peru to become the first people to conquer the untouched west face of Sihuala Grande. Spanish.
Okay.
Sihuala Grande in the Peruvian Andes.
Okay.
Simon and Joe met each other in 1984 in Chamonix in the French Alps.
Ooh.
They were there on a climbing trip with a bunch of other British climbers, just having a good time, drinking some like cheap red wine,
amazing,
going out on climbs, etc., etc. So that's where they met. They got on reasonably well. They had similar climbing capabilities, so they were like, yeah, you'll do as a friend. The idea of organizing a trip to Peru the following year was floated during that summer in the Alps.
Yeah.
And originally four of them had planned to go. But the two had to pull out as they were invited to go on a different expedition with a man named Sir Douglas Scott, who I found out is an English mountaineer, who is noted for being on the team that made the first ascent of the southwest face of Mount Everest, in 1975, and Sir Doug Scott received one of mountaineering's highest honours, the Piolet d'Or Lifetime Achievement Award, for that climb.
Oh my god.
And apparently he's just like a legend.
A big deal.
Yeah, he's a big deal. His personal style and climbs were described as visionary. So those two were like, see ya.
So
they went off, they went off to Pakistan instead.
I feel like those two, what are they called? Joe and
Simon.
Simon, they maybe should have joined.
Maybe they weren't invited and they were like, rude.
Rude, we'll make our really own rude plans.
Well, we're going to go be the first people to climb the west face of Sihuala Grande.
Sihuala Grande.
Sihuala. It's about S-I-U-A-L-A. Sihuala Grande. Okay, so at the end of that summer in the Alps, Joe decides to go and live in Sheffield, where Simon lived, because apparently there was quite a big climbing scene there. And over that subsequent winter, the initial idea of going to Peru began to really take some shape. So they chose that mountain as they felt they had graduated from an apprenticeship in the Alps, like climbing hard routes there. And although they were young, they were both decent climbers. They were both members of the Alpine Climbing Group and would climb to a very high standard. Not that I know what that would be, but this comes from the horse's mouth that they climbed very well. They wanted to do new routes where people hadn't gone before. They had heard from some of their friends in Sheffield who had climbed in the mid-70s near Sihuala Grande that the west face was unclimbed, and they knew that it had been attempted by five different expeditions that had all failed. But they were kind of like, that's what we want to do.
But we'll do it.
But we're going to make it. And so once the plan was in motion, the two boys worked throughout the winter months to save enough money for the life-changing trip. So they were going to climb it alpine style. And for those who don't know what that is,
that's me.
It's just the two of them roped together with no retreat line. So you don't fix your ropes, you don't have radios, you don't take oxygen, you just go completely
on your own as is.
And like, what season is this?
Really good question. I'm going to guess they would have tried to do it in the summer. You wouldn't want to try to climb some awful peak in the winter, right? Like, yeah, there's always snow.
That's up why there. I'm like, is it ice climbing?
Yeah,
is
it, yeah,
just rock climbing? Is it hike? I don't know what mountaineer.
Good question. Not sure. I can definitely find that out for you though, based on the time that they did it. But yes, so the Alpine style breeds a resolute sense of commitment and focus because you're like, it's just you as you are. Like, there's no help. And so if you have even a minor accident, it can be a death sentence. So it's just like you are completely committed, completely focused.
And you're tied to each other as well.
Yes, tied to each other. So against all odds, so they arrive in Peru, against all odds, after 2.5 days exhausted and out of water, they make it to the summit and achieved their aim. So they So they had achieved their ascent in good style, feeling mostly in control on the way up. But they realized, though, that they'd perhaps not looked after themselves well enough because they didn't take enough supplies like food, water, and gas because they were trying to go as light as possible.
Right.
So they don't express their elation at the achievement so much as they're mostly happy to have made it up there in one piece. They only loiter at the top for a whopping 5 minutes and take a few photos before they start back down again, as it was around mid-afternoon at the stage and they wanted to take advantage of the light.
Okay, yeah, fair enough.
In a later interview, Joe describes what it was like making it to the top. We succeeded in reaching the summit of Suala Grande 2.5 days after leaving base camp, but we were frostbitten and completely wasted. There wasn't time to hang around, so we took some pictures and started going down the North Ridge. We went as far as we could before dark, then spent the first night of the descent in a snow hole. So essentially they were like, we ain't going to head back down the West Face because the West Face was like
hella dangerous.
Yeah, insanely hard. And they were like, well, we'll hit the North Ridge because that had been climbed before. And they were like, maybe it'll be easier. They were wrong. So the next day, climbing down was difficult and they were making slow progress. About a third of the way down, Joe thinks to himself, don't fall here, as he was quite a way ahead of Simon and the rope connecting them was slack. In the next moment, Joe puts his right axe into the mountain and the ice disintegrates under the blade.
Oh.
Joe falls and lands at the base of a cliff.
Shit.
Simon feels a sharp tug on the rope and races to catch up. Upon impact, Joe's leg locks backwards, his crampons maximizing the force. And a crampon, of course, is the traction device that you attach to your footwear to improve mobility on snow and ice. The fool punches his tibia up into his femur and carries it on through his knee joint. So essentially he drives his lower leg through his kneecap and up into his upper leg.
Fucking gross. Did it go?
Yeah, like punches right up through.
Oh, nah.
So he also fractures his heel and ankle in that fall, but he doesn't notice because the pain in his leg is excruciating.
Fair enough.
It's like the lesser of two evils at that point.
Yeah, like, you know what, that's, you know, I can see that, yeah.
In shock and denial, Joe attempts to stand himself up, but he feels his bones going the wrong way. In that moment, he thinks, I'm dead, as he knows there's no chance of a rescue due to the geography of where they were. So when Simon eventually catches up, asking if he's okay, Joe is forced to reveal he has broken his leg and Simon's expression goes cold. And Simon is later quoted here, I felt pretty bloody horrified. We were still at 20,000 feet and I thought we had both had it. I knew the only thing was to try to rescue him. So if you can imagine, pre the fall, they were equal partners, you know?
Yeah.
Young, fit, decent climbers, and they were looking out for each other, but all of a sudden one is incapacitated and has become like a risk because he's just a dead weight essentially. They still had a 3,000 foot face to get down with or easy way to get specifically Joe out. As I found out, apparently a mountain rescue team needs about 8 to 10 rescuers to get someone with that sort of injury off a mountain. Shit. And nobody was coming up to get him.
It's like just them.
Joe, it's just them.
And which one fell?
Joe fell.
And Joe is the oldest or the youngest?
The older one. So Simon's the younger one, yeah.
So Simon, at 21 years old,
mm-hmm. now has this
is like
companion that,
oh dear God,
is pretty much a dead
I must
man.
Rescue him.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I am up this fucking mountain.
Yeah, yeah, literally they hadn't made it far at all.
Oh my
so
gosh.
Simon is faced with the first of two awful decisions. So remember that for later in the story.
Okay.
Should he abandon his friend, whom they both considered a bit of a dead man?
Yeah.
Or try to get him down the mountain. Joe quotes later, "I could tell by the way he looked at me that he knew I was in really deep shit. What he should have really have said was, I'll go off and get some help," which would have been a euphemism for,
bye.
You're dead. Like, yeah. You've had it. So Simon chooses the latter option, which is to try and get Joe down the mountain. And he decides that he's going to try manually lowering Joe using their ropes thousands of feet down the mountain. And at this point, the storm had started to set in.
Shit.
So he's going to try to do that through the teeth of the storm with no solid anchors and put himself at great risk.
Oh my gosh.
And so over the course of the next few hours, Simon, unassisted, lowers Joe down the northern face of Suela Grande. And as we say, he's only 21 years old.
I don't understand how he's lowering him.
So that comes in a second. It is an exceptionally tricky and painful rescue. So Simon would repeatedly anchor himself as best as he could in a snow seat before manually lowering Joe using a 45-meter rope. So every 45 meters, the knot joining their two ropes would come up and hit Simon's friction device.
Yeah.
That tug was Joe's signal to get his weight off the rope. So Simon would then unclip the rope, put the knot on the other side of the device, give three tugs to let Joe know that it was ready. He's ready to keep going.
Yeah.
And then start lowering Joe again. So Simon, after that, would then very tentatively go and meet Joe and they'd start the process again. So he just kept letting him slide down this mountain.
Is he just like sliding?
Yeah, he's just like feeding him down the mountain. So Joe's essentially just a dead weight going down, and it was
it must
only
be
been
pretty steep then,
yeah,
right?
Exceptionally. Okay. I'll show you a photo afterwards.
Jeez.
So obviously this takes a number of hours, and by dark the conditions had gotten worse than worse. Even in the afternoon, the weather was packing in really bad and they were starting to have small avalanches pour down the mountain around them.
No.
But they could see their lifeline not far below, which was the glacier. So this glacier was kind of like the salvation, like they needed to get there. The glacier meant like shelter, protection from the storm, a place where they could camp out, a place where they could reassess Joe's leg. And it's dark and it's bitterly cold. It's described as being like below freezing. Jeez. And these two young boys are like, we just got to keep going and we've just got to make it to the glacier. Get them to safety, etc. And this is where it gets sad, as they were practically there. Like, just one final effort, one final push, and they would have made it to the glacier, and, like, despite the broken leg, they would have done, they would have achieved what they'd set out to do.
Oh, dear God, what happened?
But it's pitch black, and there is zero visibility, and they are both physically and mentally exhausted. Not to mention Joe at this point has lost almost a liter of blood, and Simon's hands are frostbitten.
Yeah.
The two don't see the sheer cliff of ice directly in their path, and Simon mistakenly lowers Joe over the edge of a 100-foot cliff.
Oh, shit.
Now, of course, instead of Joe being able to support his own weight to some degree on the mountainside, he is now dangling in space with his full weight on the rope as if he were bait on a fishing line. Joe quotes, "We only had to do it 10 more times to get to the bottom of the mountain, but we didn't realize we were in line with this ice cliff sticking out from the slope. At 9:30 p.m., Simon lowered me off the edge and I came to a stop with about 100 feet of air and the shadow of a covered crevasse beneath me. The knot had reached his friction device. My weight was on the rope and he couldn't get the knot over. We were locked into this system and going to die." So Simon doesn't have enough rope to let Joe down any further, but neither does he have the strength to pull him up again and look for another way down.
Oh,
so
fuck.
He just plants himself in the snow. He's just like, I'm going to just stay right here.
Yeah.
So for the next hour and a half, Simon, 21 years old, holds the full weight of Joe. And for Joe, he's dangling there just in like, midair in the middle of a storm. Yeah. And Joe says it felt like a lifetime. And because of his injury, Joe's body was going into shock and he was developing hypothermia.
Oh.
And he was really angry because he's like, we've made it so far and we're so close to the end. And like, they've just come to a complete stop. Unfortunately, on the steep slope, in the shit-awful conditions I've written, there was no way for Simon to anchor himself fully into the mountain. He can't continue supporting the strain, and Joe's weight begins to drag him closer to the edge as well.
Oh, shoot.
Simon now faces the second terrible decision. So remember,
Do I let him go?
He had two decisions to make. To die with his partner or to break the biggest taboo in companion climbing and cut the rope on his friend. So Simon pulls his backpack around towards him and opens the top pocket, which is difficult in itself as by that point he has lost practically all feeling in his hands. He reaches in and takes out Joe's knife and proceeds to hack through Joe's lifeline.
Oh my God.
Joe falls 80 feet into the enormous crevasse below.
He cut the rope.
On his descent, Joe hits the ridge of the crevice and goes through, then smashes down into a snow ledge below. Miraculously,
He survives the friggin' fall.
How big was the fall?
80 feet, did you say?
80 feet.
Okay, I don't know.
Hashtag Google it. 80 Googling.
Feet to kilometers. Okay, wait. Meters.
Do it, and I'm gonna sip some water.
Yeah, that's 24 meters.
Yeah, that's like that's like a full building.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's insane.
That's hella high.
It's hella high, and he's already broken, like shattered his leg.
All right, and he survives the freaking fall.
So Joe survives the fall, and he looks up to the hole in the roof 80 feet above him, and not knowing the real story, He knows that Simon came off the edge. So imagine how awful this moment is for Joe. He sees the rope going up through the crevice, through the entry hole he has just fallen through with no sign of Simon. So Joe believes Simon has gone flying over the top of the cliff.
Right.
And fallen that 300 feet to the glacier below.
Mm.
So Joe thinks Simon is dead. And he thinks, okay, right. Shit. You know, survival mode. So he's like, I'm going to pull on the rope, which is tied to Simon's body, and use it as a counterweight, and then using various slings and whatnot, he's going to try to climb out.
Okay.
But he pulls on the rope, and it simply falls around him with the end frayed.
Oof.
That's when Joe makes that chilling realization that Simon had cut the line and had let Joe free fall to his death. Joe, however, was not angry at Simon. In fact, he thinks, thank Christ Simon's alive. And he's like, good on you, mate. Because he just was kind of like, good on you, mate. You've saved yourself. Apart from being his friend, Joe knows that Simon is more useful to him alive than dead. And that he will at some point be coming down to look for him. So Joe's mountaineering skills kick in. He knows that Simon will never be able to find him in the dark. And so he begins to scream his name as loudly as he can every 5 minutes. Joe quotes later, crevices are scary places to be in, especially if the thought creeps in that you're not getting out. I had this image of a long death and it burnt me to pieces. I'm really quite ashamed because I broke down. By about 9:30 in the morning, I realized Simon should have found me. So he's there all night. He was there like 12 hours. The next day, Joe makes 3 attempts to climb the overhanging ice walls with a shattered leg, but obviously can't do it. When he looks down, he sees only more darkness. So he's literally fallen onto this like little ledge, like luckily fallen onto this tiny ledge. So he can't go up. He looks down, it's just darkness. So Joe had very unluckily fallen into what is called a bergschrund crevice.
Okay.
It's a separation between a glacier and the base of a mountain, and they can be anywhere from 15 meters to 150 meters deep. Joe then makes a decision which seems to defy logic and seems counterintuitive. And
he goes down.
He decides to go further down into the diamond. So he just clips himself into his abseil and he's like, I'm going to use the rope that I have.
Yeah.
So it's like he said by the time that he'd calmed down and had spent all night screaming for Simon, he realized that, either Simon was dead, which is still likely if he had fallen at some point trying to get down to help him, or that Joe himself was dead, as Simon should have found him by then. So he couldn't go up, he couldn't go sideways, and he couldn't stay still, or he would eventually die slowly and painfully.
Mm.
And he's said that he doesn't have the courage to kill himself, which I don't know if I'd use the word courage there, but like, it was kind of like, stay there and have a slow, painful, torturous end, or...
or just end it.
Or just end it himself. Ugh, awful, awful, awful. So he figures he will use his half of the rope and go down, not knowing what he would discover. It was the most difficult decision he had ever made in his life. He knew he needed to keep his momentum going or he was dead in the water. He mm-hmm. also thought, if I was going to die, I wanted to do it in sunlight.
Oh.
Cuts me so deep.
And he was like... he had to think, he obviously had the time to think about it.
Yeah.
Being like, all right, if I'm going.
If I'm
going
to die, I want some control here.
Shit.
So, down he goes.
Down he goes. God, that's terrifying.
Another 80 feet below, so 24 meters below him, he finds a false ceiling that he could crawl across. That's kind of crawl, because obviously his leg was thicked.
Yeah.
He knows it's a false ceiling, as he can feel and hear things breaking apart beneath Ooh. Him. But on the other side, he gets to a slope, and it's very steep, and he has to climb 160 feet up the loose, powdered mountain.
160 feet. Steep. It's 48 meters. Okay.
So he's got to kind of like hobble his way up this snow mountain.
Mm.
Now, back with our somewhat hero anti-hero, Simon emerges from the snow hole on the glacier that he'd camped out in that night. He can see now in the light just how enormous the crevice is that Joe had fallen into, and immediately assumes that he couldn't have survived the fall. So his next actions are possibly where more of his later critique comes from.
Okay.
So Simon is said to have shouted to Joe across the crevice, but does not go over and look and does not go to inspect. Said he did not think of looking in, as it seemed impossible he could have survived. So he simply set off back to base camp and essentially left his friend for dead. Being like, he's dead, there's no way he could have survived. Like, Joe, are you there? No? Okay, I'm going. At around 1 o'clock that afternoon, Joe stuck his head out of the top of the crevice and managed to haul his badly broken body out. He began to laugh hysterically in the sunshine, just so relieved to get out.
Yeah.
He hadn't thought any further other than just get me out of the black hole. So he's sort of like sitting there just so relieved, and he looks off to his left, and like a long way off to his left, he sees Simon's blue rope, which Joe realizes that like Simon must have used to abseil down the glacier, as in like he's alive.
Right.
Oh my God.
Which, as we say, Joe was still pleased about. However, he is faced with another sobering realization that he's out there on his own, because you don't come back for a corpse on a dangerous mountain, apparently.
Yeah.
So, now base camp was a long way away.
Yeah.
It was about 2.5 kilometers of crevice glacier to navigate first, and then 10.5 kilometers of moraines, which are effectively mounds of debris left by glaciers and rocks. And for somebody with an able body, that last leg of the journey might have taken anywhere between 3 to 6 hours.
Okay.
But in Joe's condition, which was so awful, it takes him the better part of 3.5 days, and he had no food or water to reach that base camp with.
Isn't he on a glacier?
Huh? So yeah, he came out on... oh, he still had to get down onto the glacier, because he was at the top of the crevice. So he's got to get down onto the glacier, down off the glacier, and then he's got to, like, navigate the rest of, like, the mountainous journey.
Yeah.
So over those long and strenuous days in Peru, a lot of weird things were happening in Joe's head. Some of it delirious, some of it deprivational. At one point, he gets the song This Is The Day by the Dava. Like, that's the name of the band, is Dava. It was a song he really liked by this band that he listened to in the 80s, but he didn't realize he knew all the lyrics to, and he knew every single lyric of that song. So he just
kind of sang it to himself.
Yeah. So anger was driving him forward. essentially he was thinking like everything that's happened was so not part of the plan. Like, he wanted to climb all over the world and he wanted to live forever. And apart from his newly injured leg, he was very fit and healthy and he didn't want to die.
Yeah. I mean, fair enough.
So,
there was no anger towards...
Anger towards Simon.
That's kind of crazy.
Yeah. Because that, of course, like, gets asked, you know, he gets asked that question a lot. So it had been pretty much like 4 days, right? So Joe arrived back to base camp at 3 a.m. and Simon was set to leave at 6 that morning. So like a few hours later and he would have missed him.
Yeah.
The feeling that Joe describes as he walks into camp was like being led to the gallows and someone puts their arm around your shoulder and says, Joe, you don't have to do this. So Joe was just like beside himself crying. When he made it back. So the people at the camp were shocked. None more so than Simon.
Yeah.
So Simon had made his way back to base camp where he'd spent those few days recovering physically because, of course, his hands were so fucked. Should I swear? I shouldn't swear. His hands were fucked.
Fucked up.
And the grieving process hadn't yet started, apparently. So on that third day, he decided to pack up and leave the next morning because he was like, there's no point in me staying.
Yeah.
He was asleep in his tent when he was woken by Joe's voice calling his name. His first reaction was delight. But he was shocked when he saw Joe's condition, both physical and mental.
Yeah.
But having Joe back alive, Simon was overjoyed and emotional, albeit distressed, to see Joe in such a bad way.
Hmm.
Simon's priority was getting him to a hospital and getting him home. So after all Joe had been through, the first thing he did was thank Simon for all he'd done to get him down the mountain. Because he had done a lot.
Yeah,
if a little bit iffy towards the end. When Joe was finally in proper care, doctors unfortunately told him that the bone in his lower leg had been driven up through the knee, he would never walk again, let alone climb. As a parallel, while Joe was receiving this heart-wrenching diagnosis, Simon was off climbing the north face of the Eiger, something Joe had always wanted to do. However, Joe was determined not to accept the opinion of the doctors, and he did prove them wrong 5 years later when he climbed Amadablam in Nepal, and he knew he was back. And that, my survival guide friends, is the incredible survival story of Joe Simpson and Simon Yates, the man who cut the rope.
He climbed a mountain 5 years later?
Mm-hmm.
Is he not, like, traumatized by that experience? Also, Simon as well? While he was in...
hospital, he was like, see ya.
And he just went and climbed a freaking... Even after that, like, horrifying experience?
Yeah.
Don't you need time to process that shit?
I definitely would.
I mean, I'd be like, look, maybe I won't go see a mountain for a while.
Look, I'm just going to give it like a break.
Just give it a minute.
I think it's crazy that like, so obviously I've read up heaps and, you know, Simon was criticized by the, like, just... The mountaineering community, initially, but
the story
spread and it like hit a nerve with the public because Joe ended up writing a book called Touching the Void, which is about that, like, story. And, so Simon for like over 20 years has lived with that tagline of being the man that cut the rope, and he's been accused of being unethical and immoral, but like Joe defends him a lot. Like Simon was 21.
He will. Yeah.
And it was like, he's like, it's, I will die if I don't do this.
He was faced with two really bad options.
Yes.
Oh, it's like that train analogy of like,
oh, yes.
You know, you're the train driver. If you keep going, you're gonna...
Yeah, it splits in two, right?
Yeah,
and like on one side, there's lots of people.
Like, you've got to leave
Yeah, you decide who dies.
Like, yeah, and it's like, it would be like, okay, in this situation, if you kept going, you would hit the person and you would die because the train would just, like, fall and crash.
Yeah.
But if you, I don't know, pull the lever
it's just
and, like,
you
kill someone and, yeah. And live. Yeah, it's insane. Well, there's like a few, I've got a few questions here because the story confronts you with a number of moral conundrums and comparisons. Really, so was Simon, right to cut the rope? Would you yourself be brave, strong, weak, cut the rope in that situation, etc.? Why didn't Simon check to see if Joe was actually dead? Would you have survived? Do you think you would have survived if you'd been in that same situation as Joe? Or would you just have curled up and accepted your fate?
I feel like, you know how Simon had two choices?
Yes.
Two big decisions. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel like I would have failed the first one.
Oh, like, way back up the mountain. Yeah. When it was like, okay, he's broken his leg.
I mean, perhaps because, like, I'm not very physically able. But, like, that endeavor...
And you have no supplies either.
Yeah, like, that endeavor in and of itself is a huge task.
Yes.
And, like, I guess I would have been like, we're fucked.
Like, look, mate.
Look, mate, what do? I would have, like, sat there and, like, yelled, talked to, to him, being like, we need to flesh this out and make a decision.
Yeah.
Like, I can try, but...
Yeah,
she's not looking great.
Yeah, like, I myself have no upper body strength at all.
Exactly.
So
can I do a push-up? No.
Not one. Not a single
I can go down, but then I can't push it back up.
I can just go down, maybe, if my elbow allows it.
So
in the sense, it was like, he already redeemed his by attempting to get
him
down.
The fact that he'd done all of that, you have to think about the fact, like, he did all of that and then he was stuck with this, like, this other huge thing where he was like, okay. Like, shit, now I've got to make another decision.
Yeah.
I can't consult anyone because he's off a cliff.
Yeah, they couldn't even communicate.
Yeah.
Like, it was just, that was them. Like, there's a storm raging.
Yeah. I don't blame him for it at all.
Yeah.
And I don't blame him actually for assuming that he was dead. Like, you know how you're like, he was like the most criticized for that decision, for like not looking for him.
Yeah.
Like, you're talking about a guy who has probably not eaten or drank anything for a while. He's low energy. He's just been through a horrific ordeal.
Yes.
All he wants to do is get down to the bottom. He looked at the frickin' crevice. 24-meter fall. So, like, if you're looking at that, I think it's pretty, even irrationally, but even rationally, to think, I don't think this dude's made it.
That's, just imagine that moment. Like, he's cut the, and he's looking back at, like, the site of what he thinks is his friend's, like, grave.
Yeah.
Being like, get me out of here.
Mm. He'll be like,
I literally would have been like, mommy! Come pick me up.
Well, what I do is when I panic, I need to like take a nap. It's like a weird survival instinct.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah,
like it's nap time now. Like you're
like, I just need to lie down. Yeah, that's happened to me when I got like heat stroke.
Oh wow.
Nah, not like heat stroke, just like overheated.
Yeah, and you're like, must nap now.
I was like, must nap.
Well, there, like in another interview, so Simon obviously gets, you know, the questions get the questions get put back on him. So he says, would I have cut the rope? In Simon's situation, without a doubt. Joe's only criticism is that it took Simon more than an hour to remember that the only knife we had was in the top pocket of his rucksack. The real question is, if the knife had been in Joe's rucksack, so Simon didn't even have a knife with him in which to cut the rope, and could feel Simon being pulled down, would Joe have cut the rope to save his friend? And Joe says, no. I don't think I would. But he's like, would I have cut the rope in Simon's situation? Without a doubt.
Yeah.
So.
That's pretty interesting.
Mm.
He would save himself above all else.
It's interesting. Yes.
And it kind of sheds a light on her, that comment you made that he didn't have the courage to take his own life.
Yeah.
Like, he just couldn't.
Just couldn't bring himself. I don't know if I could. In any circumstance. I really... Oh, the thought of it. It makes me feel so
good. That situation of, like, you know you're hanging on the rope. Like, you're Joe. And you can feel him getting... Simon getting closer. You wouldn't... And you knew you had the knife.
Yeah.
It's I'd cut it, man.
Oh, gosh.
I'd cut it. Oh. Think of that situation. Like, you've... Like, yes, it was a freak accident, but you're the one who's injured.
Yeah.
Simon's already gone and done a whole lot of shit for you, like, bringing you down this mountain.
That's true.
And now you're in a situation where you're like, I'm dead meat currently. He may not be.
Yeah, he can still survive. And I feel
like he's slipping down with me.
Hoi vey. Oiest of veyest.
Oiest of veyest. But, no, you wouldn't.
Yeah. Oh, God, look. God, I don't know.
I mean, you'd have a cry for a while.
I'd probably cry. And then you'd do it. Yeah, I'd probably need a good cry. I'd probably yell and scream into the storm and...
You'd, like, have your time to... I don't know if you'd have the time, actually. I wonder how long that kind of moment was.
Which moment? Where Simon realised he needed to cut the rope.
Yeah. Kind of like that sliding.
Yes. Well, he held on for over an hour. Like an hour and a half.
That's true.
I'm guessing, so not going to lie, the thought probably crossed his mind about 4 seconds after he realised.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, fuck.
Like, oof.
Weesh.
Weesh. Weesh.
But yeah, so that's my story.
That's a pretty traumatic event.
But they both survived. I can't believe
they both survived.
Yeah.
I kind of get... Simon surviving.
Yes.
Especially after he cut the rope.
Yeah.
Like all right, your chances have increased exponentially now.
Yeah.
You don't have to bring an injured dude down. You just have to... I mean, he still was obviously malnourished.
He also didn't get attacked by, like, sort of carnivorous llamas on the Peruvian mountains on his way back.
Are llamas carnivorous?
No. But there could have been a wild pack of carnivorous llamas.
Well, I think a llama's got me.
Yeah, like he survived everything else and then the llamas got to him. But yeah.
That's crazy. That's a good story.
Thank you.
I'd never heard of it before.
No, me either. And I'm so pleased I could share it with you today.
Mountaineering sounds terrifying.
Yeah, definitely doesn't sound like my cup of tea.
Yeah.
I do like mountain. I love skiing.
I love skiing.
I love frolicking in the snow. But like,
I love climbing. I've just gotten into that, rock climbing. But like, no, not like that.
Exactly.
Ah.
Okay. Well.
Shit.
Thank you all so much for listening. Catch you next week.
Yeah, for my story. I've already prepared it. I'm very excited.
All right. See you later.
See you next time.
Bye.
The Survival Guide.
Hey guys, it's Olivia here. Thank you so much for tuning into the Survival Guide podcast. Melissa and I are brand new to this, and we really appreciate your support. We can't wait to bring you some more crazy survival stories, so don't forget to subscribe and tune in next week. You can also find us on Instagram at the Survival Guide podcast. Once again, thank you, love you, kakite, goodbye.